Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see
somebody.
Produced
at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal legal system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. Recently, at the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland, the fourth annual session of the International Independent Expert Mechanism to Advance Racial Justice and Equality in Law Enforcement held public consultations on systemic racism against Africans and people of African descent in the criminal legal system. Speakers and participants were invited to discuss obstacles, challenges, lessons learned, and promising initiatives at different stages of criminal legal proceedings, including before, during, and after a trial. They also explored how race and other intersecting factors contribute to discrimination against and disproportionate outcomes for Africans and people of African descent in the criminal legal system, as well as the correlation between racial discrimination and the overrepresentation of Africans and people of African descent in detention. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, we're going to hear a few presentations from those consultations. The first consultation, held May 7th, was on the topic, Assessing the Rights of Africans and People of African Descent at Different Stages of the Criminal Legal Proceedings, before trial. One of the speakers was Carla McCanders, director of the Thurgood Marshall Institute at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and a leading legal scholar on immigration and racial justice.
I appear before you today to emphasize the deeply corrosive effects of the excessive criminalization, particularly through surveillance and racial profiling on Africans and people of African descent in the United States. The criminalization of Black people is not incidental, it's systemic. Black people are disproportionately surveilled, stopped, and arrested, which results in Black migrants being disproportionately swept into a carceral immigration nexus that imperils their liberty, family unity, and fundamental human rights. At the heart of the Legal Defense Fund's advocacy efforts is a truth that we all must confront. The United States has built its criminal and immigration law enforcement systems on a foundation of anti-Blackness. As Chief Justice Roger Taney infamously declared in Dred Scott versus Sanford in 1857, Black people were not citizens and had no rights to which the white man was bound to respect. This ideology has never fully receded. Rather, it has been reshaped in modern forms of excessive surveillance, racial profiling, and criminalization that continue to target Black people in the United States. Today, the primary mode of criminalizing Black people, citizens and migrants alike, is through traffic enforcement. Police in the United States conduct nearly 20 million traffic stops per year, an average of 50,000 per day. Black drivers are stopped, searched, and detained at disproportionate rates, often without legal justification. These stops are not just merely inconveniences, they're gateways to a life-altering legal pipeline that can lead from roadside interrogation to incarceration and deportation. Once stopped, Black migrants are more likely to be arrested, detained, and subject to be placed in immigration custody with the United States Department of Homeland Security's Immigration and Customs Enforcement for even minor offenses like driving without a license. This is called the prison to deportation pipeline. 76% of Black migrants deported in recent years have had some prior police contact, and it's most often from a traffic stop. The United States is at an inflection point. Operation Tidal Wave launched in Florida over the past 2 months and is following the directive of a sweeping presidential executive order titled Protecting the American People Against Invasion. Even though executive orders do not have the force of U.S. law, Florida's governor, dramatically expanded the state's cooperation in what are called 287G agreements and arrested nearly 800 people, primarily through traffic stops. The data confirms that Black people in the United States, what we already know, that Black people historically, regardless of citizenship status, are not treated as foreign, but as criminals. And despite representing only 5.4% of undocumented immigrants in the United States, Black migrants account for over 20% of non-citizens facing deportation on criminal harms. The criminalization is not limited to deportation. Legal scholars described a phenomenon called slow deportation through traffic enforcement, where people are subject to fear of police contact, loss of employment, and economic precarity. To conclude, the excessive criminalization of Africans and Black people in the United States results in disproportionate policing, deportation, and societal exclusion. First of all, unfortunately, right now there is no adherence to the rule of law. The U.S. system is one of checks and balances. The legislature enacts laws, the president and executive branch execute laws, and the courts act as a check on the executive branch. Recently, the executive branch has ignored U.S. Immigration and Nationality Act and deported and indefinitely imprisoned migrants without due process. Further, the executive branch has been ordered by federal courts to return deportation flights and forbade the government to deport migrants without hearings. The executive branch has apparently ignored these rulings. These tactics are applied not only to people who are in the United States without legal status, but also those who are on visitors' visas and also have legal or lawful permanent resident status. A second intervention must be that legal protections must be designed to combat racial discrimination in immigration enforcement, especially when state and local law enforcement agencies are involved. Our research at the Thurgood Marshall Institute demonstrates there is a glaring need to address these agreements between state and local law enforcement and immigration that are disproportionately impacting Black migrants who are not our racial profiling, and they continue to funnel Black migrants into the prison to deportation pipeline. Second, the United States must take steps to decriminalize immigration status. The enforcement of civil immigration laws have long blurred the line between civil and criminal law by allowing minor infractions or civil violations to trigger severe consequences. By decoupling migration status from criminal penalties, the system can be refocused on ensuring fairness rather than perpetuating exclusion and punishment. Also, independent oversight must be established to monitor immigration enforcement and state and local law enforcement agencies engage in immigration enforcement partnerships. The enforcement mechanisms are important to rooting out racial bias and misconduct that currently goes unchallenged. And lastly, the United States needs to recognize and disaggregate the collection of data on Black migrants. The invisibility of Black migrants in the United States has long obscured the disparities that they face. Mandating the collection of public disaggregated race and nationality data within the Department of Homeland Security would improve accountability and illuminate patterns of discrimination that demand corrective action. Beyond these specific reforms, the Legal Defense Fund envisions broader constitutional and human rights principle. The human rights of Black people, whether they're citizens or migrants, are not conditional. And our research demonstrates that the enforcement often operates on a logic that treats the rights of Black people as expendable, and this must end.
That was Carla McCanders, director of the Thurgood Marshall Institute at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She was speaking during the first consultation, which was entitled Assessing the Rights of Africans and People of African Descent at Different Stages of the Criminal Legal System Before Trial. Another speaker in that first consultation was Ilyes Nagdi, racial justice director at Amnesty UK, where his work focuses on civil liberties, policing, counterterrorism, securitization, and movement building related to racial justice.
My specific intervention will highlight the use of technology by police forces in the United Kingdom against communities of African descent, racialized communities, and deprived communities. Amnesty International has found that three-quarters of UK police forces are using data-based and data-driven systems to attempt to predict, profile, and assess the risk of crime occurring in the future. The use of such approaches is influencing decisions in policing and the criminal legal system, as well as people's access to essential services. We have determined that the use of these so-called predictive policing tools in policing and the criminal legal system violates people's rights, including the right to a fair trial, the presumption of innocence, the right to privacy, the right to freedom of assembly and association, and the right to equality and non-discrimination. These systems operate as a modern method of racial profiling, reinforcing racism and discrimination in policing. They also crucially risk violations to people's economic, social, and cultural rights, such as the right to social security. Police forces use these systems to attempt to predict where crime will occur in the future, and to predict and profile who will commit crime in the future or who is at risk of committing crime or other criminalized behavior. Police then use these predictions, profiles, risk assessments to target specific areas and people and groups in those areas with increased policing. These predictions influence a wide range of policing, including surveillance, the monitoring of areas and individuals, police patrols, other targeted operations, including stop and search and arrests. These are often shared, these predictions, profiles, and risk assessments are often shared with other criminal legal system authorities, such as prosecution services, prison and probation services, as well as essential public service providers, such as councils and local authorities, and with the Department for Work and Pensions, as well as unspecified third parties. Predictive policing systems are contributing to racist and discriminatory policing and the criminalization of areas, groups, and individuals, perpetuating institutional racism in policing and society. Their use is leading to the repeated targeting of more deprived areas, which in the UK tends to include areas with higher populations of people of African descent as well as other racialized communities. So the way these systems work is they operate using data from policing and the criminal legal system. However, that data often reflects the structural and institutional racism and discrimination already present in policing, such as in police intelligence reports, suspect data, stop and search data, arrest data. There is already inherent bias in that data. For example, areas with high populations of people of African descent and other racialized communities are repeatedly targeted by police and therefore already crop up in those same police records. Black and racialized people in the UK are also repeatedly targeted and therefore already overrepresented in police intelligence, stop and search, and other police records. This data is then used in these systems to develop, train, and operate them. These biases then lead to these same systems using that data to predict crime will occur in those very same areas or that individuals from those backgrounds are likely to commit crime. These outputs then lead to the further repeated targeting of those areas and individuals, perpetuating a cycle of discrimination and criminalization. Amnesty International UK has determined that the use of these systems amounts to indiscriminate mass surveillance, which can never be a proportionate interference with the rights to privacy, expression, association, and peaceful assembly. We consider all indiscriminate mass surveillance fails to meet the test of necessity and proportionality, and therefore violates international human rights law. And we have called on states to take steps towards transparency and accountability and prohibit the use of these technologies. Thank you.
That was Ilyas Naqdi, Racial Justice Director at Amnesty UK, speaking at the fourth annual session of the International Independent Expert Mechanism to Advance Racial Justice and Equality in Law Enforcement during public consultations on systemic racism against Africans and people of African descent in the criminal legal system, which was held recently at the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland. He was speaking during the first consultation, which was entitled Assessing the Rights of Africans and People of African Descent at Different Stages of the Criminal Legal Proceedings Before Trial. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Continuing with the fourth annual session of the International Independent Expert Mechanism to Advance Racial Justice and Equality in Law Enforcement, the third consultation, also held May 7th, was on the topic Assessing the Rights of Africans and People of African Descent at Different Stages of the Criminal Legal Proceedings After Trial. One of the speakers in that consultation was Nazgul Garnoush, PhD, Director of Research at the Sentencing Project, a U.S. nonprofit organization engaged in research and advocacy for criminal legal reform, where she conducts and synthesizes research on criminal legal policies with a focus on racial disparities, lengthy sentences, and the scope of reform efforts.
We've been using the criminal trial as an organizing tool for these consultations, so before the trial, during the trial, after the trial. And one point I'd like to make is that in the United States, well over 90% of convictions are not obtained through trials, but through plea bargains. And it's partly, largely because of the threat of lengthy sentences that people face if they go to trial that fuels this high proportion of cases being resolved through plea bargains. And lengthy sentences is what I'm going to talk about today. Racial disparities in prison sentences increase with sentence lengths, and so scaling back lengthy sentences helps to reduce racial disparities. And one way that sentences can be scaled back is not just at the point of sentencing, but after the fact, through post-conviction reviews. My organization, the Sentencing Project, recommends abolishing life sentences, and we partner with organizations, with several other organizations, and have elaborated on this in a submission to the United Nations Periodic Review. My organization also recommends limiting most prison terms to 20 years. We have documented how racial disparities increase with sentence lengths in at least two ways. First, by showing how disparities increase for people who have already served at least 10 years or longer in prison. We've noted that while 14% of the US prison population is African American, the African American proportion of the whole prison population is 33%, and the African American proportion among those in prison who've served at least 10 years is 46%. We've also shown how racial disparities are extremely high for people serving life sentences. As Mr. Salim Holbrook mentioned earlier, nearly 200,000 people in U.S. prisons are serving life sentences. That's one in every six people in prison in the United States. And nearly half of this population is Black. So that 200,000 figure includes people serving life without parole sentences, life with parole sentences, and virtual life sentences that we define as up to 50 years or longer. Among people serving life without parole sentences, and that's about 56,000 people, 55% of them are African American. In addition to highlighting these problems through research, the Sentencing Project is advocating for second look reforms that allow sentences to be reduced after a period of imprisonment. Second look reforms like these have been recommended by the National Academy of Sciences as a way of reducing racial disparities in U.S. incarceration. And an example of this reform can be found in Washington, D.C. In Washington, D.C., for people who were convicted of a crime that occurred under the age of 25, after they served 15 years in prison, they can petition a judge for resentencing and have their sentences reduced or be released. Over 250 people have been released in Washington, D.C. as a result of this reform. Advocates in many states around the United States are pursuing similar legislative reforms. And in some states, notably Washington State and Michigan, courts have restricted life without parole sentences for emerging adults. And so those are, in by their definition, people whose crimes occurred under the age of 21. And Massachusetts's highest court has abolished life sentences, life without parole sentences, entirely for this group. So these restrictions build on the U.S. Supreme Court's restrictions, but not elimination, of life without parole sentences for people convicted as youth. So there's some progress, but a long way to go. I really appreciate that in its 2023 report on the United States, EMLR recommended abolishing life without parole sentences for children. I encourage EMLR to go beyond this recommendation and suggest that life without parole sentences be abolished entirely for everyone, regardless of the age at which they committed their offense, or at least recommend abolishing these sentences for people under the age of 26. And also, since life with parole sentences can go on for decades, as we've heard earlier, I encourage you to join us in recommending a very concrete maximum sentence, such as 20 years, with the exception of cases that might need prolonged sentences beyond that. Or, just as the American Bar Association has recommended, I encourage you to recommend a second look at all prison terms after 10 years of incarceration. Thank you.
That was Dr. Nazgul Gagnoush, Director of Research at the Sentencing Project, speaking at the fourth annual session of the International Independent Expert Mechanism to Advance Racial Justice and Equality in Law Enforcement, during public consultations on systemic racism against Africans and people of African descent in the criminal legal system, which was recently held at the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland. She was speaking in the third consultation, which was entitled Assessing the Rights of Africans and People of African Descent at Different Stages of the Criminal Legal Proceedings After Trial. Another speaker in that third consultation was Cam Stevens, the visionary director of the Growth App and a senior consultant at Grow, Transform, Belong Community Interest Company.
My name is Cam Stevens. I am a senior digital consultant for Grow, Transform, Belong, co-founder of the Growth App, an expert by experience for Penal Reform International, and CEO of Sphere Media. But beyond these titles, I speak to you today as someone who has lived through the justice system firsthand. My presence here is not academic, it is personal. I speak for the many thousands of people who remain voiceless behind the walls of our prisons. Across the world, from the United Kingdom to the United States and beyond, the evidence is consistent and alarming. Prisoners of African descent are subject to harsher disciplinary practices, more frequent use of force, and deeper forms of isolation. None more so damaging than the use of solitary confinement. I know what it means to be locked in a cell for 23 hours a day. I know what it does to the mind, to the spirit, and to the will to rehabilitate. Solitary confinement is not about space, it's about erasure. It strips you of connection, of routine, and often of hope. And when it is applied disproportionately to Black prisoners, it becomes a form of racial punishment, not correction. Let's look at the facts. In the UK, Black individuals represent just over 3% of the general population, but over 12% of the prison population. They are more likely to be segregated, more likely to be restrained, and more likely to face adjudications. In many cases, these punitive decisions are based on discretion, where unconscious bias is free to operate unchecked. In the US, the same story unfolds. Black and Latino prisoners are disproportionately subjected to solitary confinement, often for subjective infractions like non-compliance or disrespect. These are decisions that strip people of their mental health, and they are often made through a racialized lens. Yet we have a framework to prevent this. The United Nations standards minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners, known as the Mandela Rules, are clear. Rule number 2 prohibits discrimination on the basis of race or any other status. Rule 43 bans the discriminatory or prolonged use of solitary confinement. Rule number 44 defines prolonged as more than 15 consecutive days, beyond which the practice is widely recognized as a form of psychological torture. But these rules on paper are not protection in practice. What good are standards if they are ignored? What good are principles if they are not enforced? If we are serious about human rights, we must be serious about what happens behind the walls. So what must be done? First, we need to institutionalize transparency. All prison systems should be required to collect, publish, and review data disaggregated by race, ethnicity, and disciplinary outcomes. If the problem is hidden, it will never be addressed. Second, we must enforce the Mandela rules, not as suggestions, but as a minimum international standards. Countries should embed them in domestic law and establish independent oversight bodies with the authority to investigate racial disparities. Third, we must prioritize staff training rooted in equity, cultural, and trauma-informed practice. Reform is not only about systems, it's about people and the decisions that they make every day. And fourth, we must make space for lived experience in policy reform. As an expert by experience, I can tell you this. We don't just carry stories, we carry solutions. Include us, trust us, work with us. Because that is what justice really means. Not equality in theory, but equity in practice. Not blind punishment, but accountable rehabilitation. Not silence, but voice. Justice must begin behind the walls, because how we treat the most marginalized, those whom society have confined, defines who we are. If we mean to honor Mandela, we must do more than quote him. We must live by the standards his name now carries. It's time to break the chains. It's time for Justice 2.0. Thank you.
That was Cam Stevens, director of the Growth App and a senior consultant at Grow, Transform, Belong, CIC, speaking at the fourth annual session of the International Independent Expert Mechanism to Advance Racial Justice and Equality in Law Enforcement during public consultations on systemic racism against Africans and people of African descent in the criminal legal system, which was held recently at the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. Just a soul's intention.